are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 14th, 2016. I am Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the Gowanus, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Houman Majd. How much change do Iranians really want? We'll talk about recent elections in that country and the shifting fault lines and the baroque but interesting and important politics of the Islamic Republic. Also, the fascism in clown fascism was rearing its bloated face and head over the weekend. Trump rally canceled in Chicago because of people protesting against his racism and bigotry. Trump now threatening to send his supporters to other campaigns, floating the notion that he'll help cover the legal expenses of supporters of his that get into physical altercations. Marco Rubio is really troubled by all this, but still can't bring himself to say he won't vote for Trump. And of course, it's all still somehow Obama's fault. Right. Major terrorist attack in Turkey. About 30 people killed there. Bomb exploded. Car bomb in Ankara. Turkish government blaming Kurds. Maybe Kurds, but not the faction they're blaming. And it could be ISIS. And the Democrats met yet again for a town hall, also conveniently scheduled for Sunday evening. Can't seem to get a hang of that. And President Obama has outlined his foreign policy, and it is restrained, and it's prudent, and it's sane, and people are going to miss him, even those of us who disagree with him in many ways. There's a problem, apparently, on the stream, everybody. I'm not entirely sure what it is. It came up when we were starting. That's why we're starting late. So apparently we're not on YouTube for a live stream today. Sorry about that. This will be posted on YouTube later so you can get the visual product as well. If you're listening to this, you're obviously streaming this live on our website, which you can do. You can take me down now, Matt. So sorry about that, and sorry about the tech problems. We're going to get to Houman Majd in just a moment. We don't have any ad copy today, so we can move fast. I really want to thank everybody that subscribed to Two Dope Boys on iTunes. And many of you have written reviews, and I've really, really appreciated it. And, you know, we're endeavoring to build. It's a different kind of show. It's a culture show. It's an idea show. But we want it to be entertaining. We want it to have the same kind of attitude in some ways of the Majority Report. And hopefully, you know, my humble desire is that it's a show that many of you and other people outside of this universe come to really enjoy and rely on for the topics we cover. So if you can, if you haven't already, subscribe to us. You can go to subscribe, the number 2db.com. Subscribe, the number 2DB.com. Follow us at Two Dope Boys Pod on Twitter. Thank you so much. We'll be right back with Human Majd.
I sip the Dom P, watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes. All the words past the margin, the whole of mic I'm throbbing. Mechanical movement, understandable smooth issue that murderers move with. The thief's theme, the play me at night, they won't act right. The fiend of hip hop has got me stuck like a F pipe. The mind activation, react like I'm facing time like Pappy Mason. With pins I'm embracing, wipe the sweat off my dome, spit the phlegm on the streets. Sway Tim's on my beats, makes my cypher complete. Weather cruising in a six cab, I'm on tarot deep, I can't call it. The beats make me falling asleep, I keep falling. But never falling 6 feet deep, I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for dead presidents to represent me.
Whose world is this?
The world is yours, the world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
The world is yours, the world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Human Majd. He is the author of The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, The Ayatollah's Democracy and The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, and he's a contributor at NBC News. Human, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate your perspective on Iran immensely, because what you do is you sort of get us inside the internal dynamics of Iran politically, culturally, and in terms of its foreign policy. And I think you've illustrated for a number of reasons that, you know, Iran is a country that has a sort of serious internal debate within its system, and it can be parsed and understood in that way. And I think that's a very important framework to come from. So with that kind of table set, there were recent elections in Iran that happened earlier this month. Before we get to the results, we see these terms thrown around: moderate, conservative, hardline, pragmatic, liberal. Explain what those terms mean in an Iranian context, and then we'll get to the results.
Right. Well, it's hard to describe what those terms necessarily mean, because they mean different things to different people, even inside Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, it'd be like saying, what exactly does a progressive mean in terms of, like, the Democratic primaries today in America? It would be hard to say who is the progressive in the primaries, because some people would argue that Bernie Sanders isn't even a progressive, having been, you know, part of the political establishment for so many years, although I would argue that he is. But anyway,
yourself the tweets. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make, yes, is that basically it's very difficult to say. I mean, those words and those terms semantically mean basically what they say. I mean, conservatives like they are in America. They want to conserve the system. They want to conserve what they have. They want to be slow moving in any change, if there's any change to be had at all. Moderates are people who want change, but and seriously want change, and believe in social moderation as well as and political moderation as well as political moderation. And obviously the reformists want change and want more rapid change for the better, for more towards a democracy that we would understand, or we would in the West recognize, than either the moderates or the conservatives, who don't want it at all. Moderates want it slowly and over time, and not drastic change. And reformists, who are accused by the hardliners of wanting a revolution, don't want a revolution, but want pretty drastic changes. Yes.
So, with that in mind, explain to us, through the kind of prism of these factions, what happened earlier this month, and maybe as part of that, explain where President Rouhani fits on this spectrum.
Yeah, well, things change. People's opinions change. Rouhani started out as a conservative in his career, very much a conservative, and has grown to become a moderate perhaps even leaning a little bit to the reform side. And certainly his support comes from the reason he became president, and a lot of his support, certainly in urban areas, comes from those who would consider themselves reform supporters or reformists. What happened was there was an election for parliament in Iran, and for the Assembly of Experts, which is a body that doesn't have very much to do except for every time the supreme leader dies, vote on who the next supreme leader is going to be. And that's a body that's voted on by the public every 8 years. And in this case, in this particular election, a number of hardline ayatollahs, very old but also very hardline ayatollahs, lost in the election, as did quite a few of the hardliners, hardline conservatives, in the parliament. So the elections were significant in that not only, unlike 2009, there were no accusations of any kind of fraud to keep the hardliners in power, but that there was a pretty large turnout for an off-presidential year election in Iran, as it is pretty much everywhere in the world. Elections tend to be most highly have the highest turnout when there's a president or a prime minister involved, and lower turnouts when the stakes aren't quite as high. And in this case, Iran was the same thing, except that the turnout was higher than expected, partly because the reformists managed to get their supporters to come out in force. And this includes a lot of young people, and I have to say that Iran is a very young population. More than two-thirds of the population are under 30 years old. And the reformists and some moderates were able to get these young people to come out and vote for them. So it was significant in that regard.
So this is interesting because going off of that distinction and kind of reviewing I think some people have memories of the Green Movement, and that was, I have vivid memories of that. I was just graduating college, in fact, and the images of the Green Movement gripped the world. It was definitely a symbol of resistance, of civil rights, of progress. People kind of interpreted their own meanings into the Green Revolution, and I think your explanation of it actually gives people a more kind of canny sense of what's happened since 2013, and we'll get to that in a moment. But you explained that the Green Revolution, which I should say was the result of a contested election, the re-election of President Ahmadinejad in 2009, and opposition candidates, Museveh, Mehdi Karoubi, took to the streets to say that the results had been fraudulent, and there was a mass uprising, and it was violently put down by the state. And outside of Iran, the interpretation was from many people, maybe particularly in the United States, the West, that this was a movement of revolution. This was about getting rid of the system, getting rid of the Islamic Republic, and people wanted a fresh start and something entirely new. President Obama was actually really criticized for not speaking out on behalf of the Green Revolution as strongly as some would have liked, and his kind of dual explanation was, well, actually, the people that are sort of the reformists, they don't have a particularly different attitude towards our foreign policy conflicts. And then his second point, I think, that he also alluded to is me coming out and voicing support isn't necessarily going to, you know, help them in Iran.
Right.
But you really explained and anchored the Green Movement as a conflict within the context of the Islamic Revolution and not one that stepped outside of it. So can you explain that, and then we'll move into the post 2013 period?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question that in that Green Movement, in those protests of the Green Movement, there were certainly elements within the protesters who wanted a complete revolution, who were fed up and disgusted. And if they hadn't wanted a revolution prior to the movement, decided that once the fraudulent vote was announced in their minds that at that point the Islamic Republic was not savable and therefore had to be completely changed. However, I think the number of people who actually wanted a revolution were in the minority. I think the vast majority of people who came out and demonstrated were genuinely upset with what they saw as the state preventing them from exercising their right to choose their leader in the first place, mm-hmm. and then following up by preventing them from exercising their constitutional right to protest, and of course preventing society from not just reform but of progress, and progress as was defined by the reformists, and particularly Mousavi, who was supported by Khatami and Rafsanjani and various other reform-minded or moderate politicians. So it was a real affront to people, but that wasn't, it's still, despite that affront, it wasn't universally accepted that the Islamic Republic needs to fall. I mean, we have to remember that Iranians had experience with revolution, mm-hmm. and for many Iranians, the revolution had not quite been what they had expected it to be. I'm talking about the 1979 revolution.
Right.
For younger people, and many of them weren't born at the time of the revolution, who were out there protesting, they knew about the revolution and the dashed hopes of the revolution through their parents and their grandparents. So that history is young. It's like, you know, 30 years after the revolution is not a long time in the history of a nation. And so they didn't really want a revolution because nobody was offering an alternative to what the Islamic Republic represented. And for many Iranians, despite the shortcomings, the democratic shortcomings of the Islamic Republic, there is some participation in political life for them. There is some ability to change their destiny, and they recognize that. And it's not perfect, but it's not an absolute dictatorship in the way some other countries are, or in the way some of even the Arab nations that a year later started, or a year and a half later, started experiencing what became the Arab Spring. Iran was not in that situation, and no one, certainly not the leaders of the Green Movement, were suggesting that the whole system needs to be scrapped and they got to start all over again. But again, as I said, people with knowledge of the revolution that preceded this potential revolution did not want a repetition of that, at least for a large part. Most people didn't want that. So I described it more as a civil rights movement than a revolutionary movement. Even at the height of the civil rights movement, while there were people in America who did want a revolution and an overthrow of the American system, the vast, vast majority of people were looking to change things, not to overthrow the government of the United States.
Right. So this brings us to the role of two important characters, I think. One is the Supreme Leader, obviously. And then you mentioned Khatami, who was the president in the late 90s and early 2000s. And this, he was someone who I would consider, and correct me if I'm wrong, much more firmly in the sort of moderate to even kind of liberal wing
very much a liberal,
a liberal, very sincere about reform, and someone who has been shut out of the political process and apparently not trusted by the Supreme Leader. So the brand of the Supreme Leader is that he's quite conservative, but you paint a picture of him as being more pragmatic, so that after the Green Movement was shut down and Ahmadinejad was returned to office, he actually was not happy with Ahmadinejad. And that set the stage for Rouhani and this kind of pragmatic bent. And in some respects, you've made the argument that part of the reason that Rouhani could do things that Khatami, as an example, couldn't do in foreign policy is because of the trust of the Supreme Leader. And there's a kind of convergence now where Khatami, who's not allowed to run and not, you know, is sort of shut out of public life to a degree, but still is very influential, is clearly telling people to give your support to Rouhani and his faction if you want to support some reform. And then the Supreme Leader, who shut out Khatami, is also saying, Rouhani, it's okay when he does this because he's sort of in my circle.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think the Supreme Leader feels threatened by Rouhani
right.
In the way that he felt threatened probably And again, I'm speaking for the Supreme Leader when I probably shouldn't, because nobody really knows what goes on in the mind of someone, and we're trying to psychoanalyze someone.
I'll do it. So yeah, I'll correct you if you're wrong. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, but I think that yeah, I don't think the Supreme Leader feels threatened by Rouhani. He may feel threatened by some aspects of Rouhani's rule, but I think that, and he will, you know, make corrections as he sees fit when Rouhani moves a little bit too far to the left, as it were. But yes, I think he felt that. I don't think the Supreme Leader ever felt that Khatami is the enemy, mm-hmm. that he is intentionally doing something to bring down the Islamic Republic or to, you know, bring down the Supreme Leader's office and get rid of it, for example. I think he felt, the way I see it, and from my experience in Iran, I think the Supreme Leader and those who supported him closely felt that Khatami was dangerous in the sense that he brought out emotions among people and desires among people that would lead potentially to a revolution or to a coup or to a change that they would not be happy with, perhaps not even intentionally. Whereas with Rouhani, they don't feel that that danger exists. Although, that said, there are hardliners in Iran who attack Rouhani every single day. And criticize him every single day. Hardliners who have normally been associated with the Supreme Leader's office, the editor of Kayhan newspapers, consistently criticizing Rouhani and criticizing Zarif, his Javad Zarif, his foreign minister. So it's a complicated thing. Iran's complicated,
sure.
And it's very difficult to put into. But the main takeaway from this is that there is politics in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It's real.
Mm-hmm.
Things are not the same as they are, I would say, even in Egypt. For many people, I mean, in Egypt there are many, many, many more social freedoms, but political freedoms are practically non-existent right now. Certainly in the Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states, political freedoms are non-existent as well. Whereas and in Saudi Arabia's case, there are no social freedoms either.
Right.
So again, as I said, the takeaway is that this Iran isn't what we imagine it to be. On the other hand, there are some serious questions and serious problems that Iran has to figure out. The revolution is now 37 years old. It needs to mature. Some would argue it doesn't need to mature. In fact, the hardliners argue that it shouldn't mature and it should always be a revolutionary state. I think the reformers believe in the revolution, but also want it to move forward from that revolutionary state to what we would call a normal industrialized country that may have some revolutionary ideals, but functions not primarily as that, more as a normal country, and I think that's the direction that Iran's headed. Certainly, the pragmatists and the moderates that we talked about earlier, such as Rouhani and such as Rafsanjani, believe in that as well now, because. For those kinds of people who were conservatives at the beginning, or even hardliners in some mm-hmm. cases at the beginning of the revolution, they have come to realize that without reform, without change, without moderation, and without pragmatism, Iran's more likely to lose the revolution, as it were, than to keep it, or to keep the Islamic Republic as it is. So,
So it's time for the Deng Xiaoping phase, according to these people, to sort of carry the analogy in some respects. But if...
You could, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. But not the Gorbachev.
Not Gorbachev, right.
Yeah, because Gorbachev, even though he probably wasn't intending to bring down the fall of the Soviet Union, his rule led to the fall of the Soviet Union. That's not what these people, even the reformists, would argue something that they want. And especially, the Green Movement happened in 2009. The Arab Spring started in 2010, 2011, and late 2010, early 2011. And the Iranians look at the Arab Spring, having preceded the Arab Spring with their own sort of, uprising, if you want to call it, in the aftermath of the 2009 elections, and look at it with horror say, oh my God, I mean, aren't we happy that we didn't go all the way or try to go all the way and either have the country descend into civil war, particularly when they look at Syria, or have it become a failed state like Libya, or worse, almost worse for some, have the initial euphoria of changing the system the way we want to change it, and then have an almost more aggressive dictatorship replace what we just replaced,
right?
Such as Egypt.
Such as Egypt.
So
right. Right.
Yeah.
So
I think that, you know, for Iranians are very well aware of the of their neighborhood and what's been going on in their neighborhood. And one thing they don't want, they know, is that kind of change in Iran.
So I think it's clear that, you know, no one from Khatami to obviously the most, you know, hard line in the leadership wants to be Gorbachev in the sense of taking down the system inadvertently even. But I think the question is, if we looked at it in terms of kind of different sort of blocks, so in terms of foreign policy and in terms of Iran's role in the world, it does seem that even as of, you know, there's going to be disputes about, you know, supporting Hezbollah, there's disputes about Syria. I mean, these are very, there's disputes about, you know, Israel, obviously, but that basically clearly people like Rouhani and Zarif and with the negotiations with the United States, P5+1 and everything else, that this is a group of people that desires to be a normalized country in the global system and to have trade and to have free travel and to, you know, gain the benefits of open markets and technology. It seemed like with people like Khatami, that was very synchronized with some type of agenda that was very clear on kind of at least loosening some social restrictions in Iran, at least improving some of the human rights aspects. With the more kind of reform, moderate or pragmatic, whatever the kind of word we want to use, is that synchronized in the same way? Or does it actually almost become potentially the opposite where, you know, the right needs to back off on foreign policy and the revolutionary nature of the state so they get to maybe have more free rein at home to push a restrictive social agenda? I mean, how is that playing out?
Well, I think you know, you're right. I think the moderates have I mean, it's been proven in the last couple of years that the moderates have and the pragmatists who are in control of the government right now have shown themselves to not be willing to move rapidly on the social aspects and the social freedoms that many Iranians crave, along with opening to the West, et cetera, and trade and all that stuff that you just mentioned. Whereas Khatami was very keen on opening up the social sphere for young Iranians, which it is very important for particularly young people. It's important.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it remains to be seen. I mean, for the last 2.5 years of the Rouhani presidency, those in charge, himself and his cabinet, who some of whom are actually reformers, not moderates, or real reformers who worked with Khatami, I think the priority has been to first normalize relations with the West, excluding the U.S. at this point, but normalize relations with the West first. Through the nuclear deal, get rid of the sanctions, better the economy so that people who, you know, the vast majority of people in any country are more concerned about their, you know, jobs and their income and being able to survive and being able to eat than they are necessarily about political freedoms right away.
Sure.
First, you got to provide them with that in a country like Iran, in a developing country like Iran. So I think, you know, the idea has been to take care of that first. Do not fight two battles on, do not fight the battle on two fronts. Do not fight the war on two fronts. And I think it remains to be seen whether after this nuclear deal, after the benefits become visible to people, and they haven't yet, and who knows when they will be, but once they do become visible to people, will Rouhani and his team then be able to pursue or push for some of those changes and reforms in the social atmosphere, social sphere, as they have promised, as they promised in their first campaign, in their first presidential campaign? It's hard to say whether they'll be able to do that, because obviously this is something that the hardliners are going to be opposed to, vehemently opposed to. They were opposed to the nuclear deal, but the Supreme Leader lent his support to the Rouhani administration. He was able to make that deal. On social reforms, political reforms, more freedom, It remains to be seen. It's hard to say whether the Supreme Leader will back him on some of those reforms, just to not completely undermine him, or whether none of his social reforms will come about. I would argue that he is a very intelligent, bright politician, crafty, and able to get his way. I think that given time, he probably will be able to. But it may even be in his second term and not in his first term in office. So, again, it's a difficult thing to say. Predicting Iran is impossible, as you have witnessed yourself.
Yes,
by reading
yes.
news. You know, everybody predicts something, and then the exact opposite happened. I mean, in these most recent elections, I have to say nobody predicted that the chairman of the Assembly of Experts would be voted out, a hardline Ayatollah. It was beyond belief almost. And that the Supreme Leader's own son-in-law would be voted out of Parliament, and that that would stand. That sort of proves that there was no fraud, because if there was going to be fraud, they could have kept him in. And nobody would have said, oh, that's fraudulent, because nobody expected him to be kicked out of the parliament or to be voted out of parliament, or for Mohammad Yazdi to be the chairman of the Assembly of Experts to be eliminated from the Assembly of Experts. So I think that, the unpredictability of Iran means that we often have to play catch-up.
Right. Houman, as a final question, and I'm just, you can take this in a very broad way, but I'm curious about this, and I think that this would be interesting for people to hear, especially because these kind of themes of Islam and democracy and Islam and human rights are very prevalent in the conversation right now. When President Khatami kind of articulated his vision of really what a liberalized Islamic democracy would look like, but still rooted in a kind of Islamic tradition. I mean, I think for a lot of people listening and viewing, they couldn't even conceive of where that would like even come from to begin with. So, I mean, is there a way you could give a sort of very brief, very kind of broad strokes, kind of panoramic snapshot of what that ideological framework or what that would look like? A liberalized Islamic democracy of the one envisioned by Khatami.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for him, and it's hard. Yeah. I mean, this is, when he gives a speech on Islamic democracy, it's hours long. So,
right.
In a few minutes, it's hard to say. I think, but we have to think of it let's look at it through our own eyes, the Western eyes, of what a religious democracy might be. We don't call the American democracy a religious democracy, because it isn't. It's a secular democracy, and yet it is formed in Judeo-Christian principles. And I think that that's basically, to break it down to, one sentence, that's basically what Khatami would argue, is that Iran is going to be a democracy in every aspect, except it's going to be formed by Islamic values rather than Judeo-Christian values, which in many cases overlap anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that Sharia law will be always applied. It doesn't mean that the Ten Commandments in the U.S. are always applied, although they used to be. But in an evolution of a political system in Iran, you can start out somewhere and say, look, the country is Islamic. The majority of people who don't live in urban centers, who, exclude the 7 or 8 million, 10% of the population who are essentially secular, even if they may be somewhat religious at home. The rest of the country is actually pretty highly religious and highly, I would say in some ways you'd have to look at them, many Iranians, as in the same way you look at many Americans outside of the American urban centers, where they're also very highly religious and, go to church on the weekend, on Sundays. And it's the same with Iranians. And I think the reason Khatami brings up Islamic democracy is because the failure of someone like the Shah, who preceded the Islamic Republic, was that he didn't recognize that Iran was religious or outside the urban centers, and didn't accommodate that religiosity. Now, you could argue that we don't need to or we shouldn't accommodate that religiosity. And yet, our own Republican Party seems to think that it has to accommodate it. And even, I would say, the Democratic Party does as well, to some degree,
to some degree, accommodate that
religiosity of the American people. Mm-hmm. And that's where the argument is for Khatami. It's a different kind of religiosity, but it needs to be accommodated.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, to make it very simple, there won't be any nude beaches in Iran. There won't be any topless beaches in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that women have to wear a hijab. In the minds of people like Khatami, have to wear a hijab. But they have to be modest, because that accommodates the values, the Islamic values and Islamic, and it's a nod to the Islamic nature of the country. In the same way that in, you know, certain parts of this country, you know, certainly you would not expect a woman to be nude on the beach, or would not expect her to take her top off on a beach, whereas in France or in Italy, it's perfectly normal and perfectly acceptable. So every country has its own, you know, cultural boundaries, and Islam has boundaries on top of the Persian cultural boundaries, and that's when they say they want an Islamic republic that reflects the reformist, that reflects the population, because much of the population doesn't want the cultural Judeo-Christian values that come with the West.
Human Maj, it definitely makes sense. I think it's just good for people to get at least some flavor of what that conversation sounds like, and whether they like it or not, that's fine. But I think it's good to flesh some of these things out.
Yeah, but it's an argument that goes on argument that goes on every day in Iran, and different reformists will have different ideas.
Sure.
And the majority of the people who are in the reform camp will agree that in general they don't want a revolution, they don't want to change the Islamic nature of Iran, but they want some freedoms that they don't have right now.
Absolutely. And that comes across again and again in the writing, your writing, and in what we can kind of glean from the situation. And Human Maj, I always learn tremendous amount talking with you, and I look forward to talking about Chronics and Bob Marley on my other podcast with you.
You got it. No problem. I'd love to.
All right. Great. Okay. Take care, man.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Sure. You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, everyone. We are going to get to the fun half in just a moment. Human Maj, the reason I say that is, I mean, we're friendly and he's great. He was also, before his writing career, he was an executive at Island Records. So we talk music.
While you were having that conversation, I realized that Human Maj wrote the second book I ever bought on Audible.
Which was?
Ayatollah Begs to Differ.
That is one of the best. I mean, the Ayatollah Begs to Differ is a tremendous book. I really recommend that to anybody who wants to understand Iran. It's indispensable, and it's really well written.
And on the Audible version, he reads it himself, which I always appreciate.
Oh, cool.
You should give out do we have a code for Audible?
We don't have a code majority? For Audible today. I don't know. Do we?
Try majority or just
try majority or
just
majority
email us
report.
If you want to use
yeah.
it.
But yeah.
Yeah, I recommend that.
Yeah, Ayatollah Begs to Differ is a great book, and it's funny. I read that book again. It was pretty shortly after college, and I was traveling in Jordan. I read that on the beach in Aqaba. Definitely not a topless beach. Become a member of the Majority Report. Go to majority.fm/become a member. That's what makes all of this possible. Give us a review on iTunes. If you're a member, still subscribe to us on iTunes, because that helps move us up in the rankings. It's tremendously helpful for the show. Subscribe to us on YouTube/Sam Cedar. And apparently some of you didn't know this, I guess, because of how the updates work. But you got to subscribe to the channel and check the channel, because in addition to clipping many things from these programs, which you can watch in whatever way you want to find the segment, you want to find an interview, it's all there. I do Majority X segments. So those are specific standalone segments which you won't get on the show. Debunked, which is about conspiracy theories and rumors. Global Quickie, which is an international relations topic of the week, an international affairs, a global story, and everything you need to know in 3 minutes, where it sounds just like what I said it is. So, you know, recently that's how the whole regressive left debate thing started. Also did something on 3 minutes outlining what Bernie Sanders' foreign policy is, who's really being misogynist to Hillary Clinton on the internet, all of that. So definitely like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook. share our content on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Facebook's at The Majority Report. On Twitter, it's at majority.fm. Use our Amazon link. Use our Jet.com link. I've actually heard really good things about Jet.com, and I believe you still get 15% off of your first purchase, and it's a socially responsible and socially clean company. What else am I missing? 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Sitting at the pen.